Good afternoon or good morning to our attendees in the Western time zones, and welcome to this EHE-sponsored webinar entitled Safely Managing Construction and Renovation and Maintenance in Healthcare, a Facilities Management Perspective. Hello, my name is Kevin Coughlin, and I am the Director of EH&S Compliance and Environmental Health and Engineering. Today's webinar will focus on the Joint Commission requirements for the Pre-Construction Risk Assessment, or PCRA, process, including infection control risk assessments, interim life safety measures, and other common construction healthcare risks from a facilities management point of view. A second webinar on Thursday of this week will address these requirements from an infection control standpoint. First, a few logistics for today's webinar. We are broadcasting, but we are not receiving today, so you cannot ask a question via your telephone. If you do have a question, please type your question into the chat box on the right side of your screen at any time during the presentation, and we'll answer as many as possible during the 15-minute Q&A period at the end of this presentation today. We are recording the audio portion of the webinar, and we'll make this available within a few days for download. You will be notified by email when this is available. So just some brief information on EH&E. We are a consulting firm that specializes in support of critical environments, both the environment itself, building systems, and the processes within it. We currently manage the Environment of Care and PCRA programs at several large research institutions, so our consulting staff is well-versed on your day-to-day needs. Today's presenter is Brian Connors, Senior Scientist and Healthcare Practice Leader at Environmental Health and Engineering. Brian has extensive program management experience in environmental health and safety programs in both the healthcare and biotechnology sectors, including nearly 10 years of direct program management responsibility in several tertiary care hospitals. Brian will now start today's program. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Kevin. Well, today we're going to speak about the Joint Commission requirements of the pre-construction risk assessment. We'll actually provide some case studies and examples of what can go wrong, and then proven management techniques that achieve Joint Commission compliance, but also, very importantly, move your program beyond compliance into true risk reduction and liability reduction. We'll also give an example of a management tool used to manage both program data and program documents. We all know how important documentation is from a Joint Commission perspective. Throughout the presentation, I will make reference to the pre-construction risk assessment management process. In EH&E's view, management is really critical to the success of your PCRA program, and so we'll give examples of proven management techniques throughout the presentation. Great. So why do we care about the pre-construction risk assessment? We'll give some examples of why we care about this process. We all know that healthcare institutions are continually evolving. Think for a moment what your hospital looked like 10 years ago, and now imagine how it will look in another 10 years. Construction, renovation, and maintenance is needed to meet the ongoing demands for hospital services, from new surgery centers to radiology to cardiac surgery. Construction, renovation, maintenance is needed now and will be needed to meet the ongoing demands for service. And so really there are some fundamental goals to this pre-construction risk assessment process. Those goals include protecting the health and safety of patients, staff, visitors, contractors, and vendors, minimizing the disruption to operation and renovations, and also really improving the workflow through an effective management process. We've seen at many hospitals where complaints from nursing staff and hospital staff can really impact workflow. It can cause stoppages to construction process. So really one of the goals of this PCRA program is to improve workflow and ensure you don't have those critical work stoppages. And then also maintain compliance with the regulations and guidelines associated with the pre-construction risk assessment. That photograph to the right of the slide is Aspergillus niger. It was just last week where a news story detailed a lawsuit that was brought against the hospital due to the death of three pediatric patients. That lawsuit alleged that all three deaths were caused by a hospital-acquired aspergillosis infection, which is a type of fungal infection. And that lawsuit alleged that the three deaths were caused by, or the three Aspergillus infections were caused by a renovation project directly below an oncology floor where all three patients spent time prior to their deaths. The risks in healthcare due to construction are real. Okay, so we're going to give you the answers right in the beginning of our webinar. EH&E has been involved in this pre-construction risk assessment process for nearly 2 decades, and we've really found some proven success strategies to assure the programs work effectively. We'll list out those success strategies early in the presentation and then revisit them throughout the presentation. So those keys to success for an effective pre-construction risk assessment include the following. Clear responsibilities. There are many individual tasks associated with the pre-construction risk assessment, such as documentation, inspections, contractor training, program oversight. All of those unique subtasks must be clearly defined, and you must define the responsibilities for those tasks. Central coordination. This is really a management process, as I talked about earlier. It involves an awful lot of coordination, from utility shutdowns to hot work permitting processes to communication to folks who work at the hospital, on the nursing floors, nursing staff, to contractor training and communication. Really, we found that central coordination is a key success to a successful pre-construction risk assessment process. A consistent, but not only consistent, but also an effective review process. So from your committee reviews to inspections to permitting, you have to ensure that outputs that go into this PICRA program result in the same control measures or mitigation measures. Metrics and follow-up are very key to a successful pre-construction risk assessment process. You must select meaningful metrics of the effectiveness of your program, but also after you select, track, and trend those metrics, you want to ensure you use those metrics to manage the program. And then lastly, contractor and subcontractor training is a key formula to success for your PICRA program, which we'll talk about in this next slide. Constructing an office building, apartment building, or even a major university is unlike conducting construction or renovation in a hospital. Hospital environments are very unique. The risks due to construction, renovation, and maintenance activities are really unlike any other environment. Examples of these unique risks due to construction and renovation in healthcare include immune-sensitive patients and the risk for construction-related hospital-acquired infections, such as the aspergillosis we talked about a few minutes ago. Patients who are unable or incapable of self-rescue in the case of a fire or other emergency, and therefore the fire risks are of critical importance. Patients who rely upon life support equipment or medical gases, excessive noise, vibration, and indoor air quality impacts can really have an impact on patients' well-being and healing. Due to all these risks, setting the expectation and proper training of contractors and subcontractors is critical. Building a commercial office building, again, is very different than constructing a hospital construction or renovation. So the challenge is that every employee of each and every contractor and subcontractor must be made aware of this reality and what actions are required to keep our patients safe and our hospitals operating. The risks in healthcare are real, and I'll give you an example of one of those risks. This was a fairly small renovation project. It was being conducted adjacent to an occupied intensive care unit. What happened in this particular case was that the evening shift had come on and had some spot welding or soldering to do, so some hot work to do. Unknown to him, there was a compressed gas cylinder of acetylene gas that was stored in one of these nearby job boxes, shown in that picture on the left. These metal boxes, these job boxes, are typically located all over construction and renovation areas. The compressed gas acetylene must not have been properly closed or was leaking. Therefore, the contents of that acetylene cylinder had filled up the job box. That job box was acting like a confined space. The welder turned on his torch to do that welding or soldering. And what happened next? Was this flash explosion due to the heat source from the welder's tank next to that job box? What you're looking at is what was left over of the job box after the explosion. You can see the damage it did in the small renovation area, which was located directly next to an occupied intensive care unit. The risks to construction and healthcare are real. In this particular case, the local fire department abated the hospital's ability to conduct any non-emergency hot work, effectively halting construction or renovation area for over a month while they addressed their systems issues and allowed them to move on to conduct safe hot work in this particular hospital. Issues like this can result in OSHA violations, not only for the contractor, but also for the hospital. There are some root causes to accidents like this: contractor training, internal competencies and skills. You have to recognize that there are risks to hot work and have mitigation strategies in place to abate those risks. Specifically, a program for flammable gas storage and a sign-in and sign-out log for the flammable gas storage, as well as storing those in a well-ventilated area outside of this construction, could have prevented this accident. I want to ask you, do you know whether flammable gas cylinders are stored in job boxes in your construction areas and renovation areas? Do you have processes in place to ensure that they're properly stored and secured? So the risks are real. We'll be talking about this pre-construction risk assessment, this management process. And really, this PCRA program is an umbrella program. It covers construction risk management for the infection control risk assessment, life safety, interim life safety, and other construction risks, including the impact on utilities and impacts from noise, vibration, and indoor air quality. So typically, this PCRA program is made up of an evaluation panel or committee. On that committee are infection control practitioners, risk management, facility design, construction, infection control, environmental health and safety. And so this program requires central coordination and oversight as these risks may interact with each other. Just a brief example of this is management and coordination of utility and fire detection system shutdowns is critical in healthcare environments. Shutdowns may have impacts on other life safety or general safety programs as well. You really have to make sure that a successful PCRA program has a central coordination built into its management scheme. We've often seen PCRA programs with various program elements from infection control to life safety to communication with the hospital is conducted in silos. And EH&E has found those programs do not operate as effectively as a program where the individual elements are coordinated. So this makes up our PCRA program. I do want to make note that this PCRA program is also very effective for small renovation projects and maintenance as well at your hospital. Okay, so what we're going to talk about for the next couple of slides are the specific requirements from the Joint Commission. So Joint Commission lays out some specific requirements on which risks you must assess and mitigate prior to construction. Again, I really want to make this note that it should be conducted prior to construction. The Joint Commission specifically requires that you assess the impact of air quality, fire and life safety, infection control, and then the impact on patient comfort and well-being from noise, vibration, or any impacts to the utility system. So here's an example of an impact on air quality. In this particular example, we're at the outside of a hospital. The photograph to your left shows a piece of diesel-powered equipment. The photograph to your right shows an air intake directly next to that diesel-powered equipment. And then this is kind of a little dead-end area where odors or any air contaminants were trapped. This particular air intake led to an operating room at this hospital. And so this piece of diesel-powered equipment was turned on. Within a few minutes, staff within the operating room pulled the fire pull station and reported seeing smoke and smelt fire. We traced that source back to this piece of diesel-powered equipment. So here's an example of potential impact on air quality. Some potential root causes to how something like this could happen. Again, training for your contractors and subcontractors, internal skills and competencies to assure that the program, that the construction is managed, that wouldn't cause an impact such as this, which resulted in potential evacuation of an operating room. Specifically, having a person or persons delegated with the responsibility to ensure that diesel-powered equipment or other sources of odors is not used directly next to an indoor air take could have mitigated this risk. Okay, the second impact we'll talk about is the impact on fire and life safety. So there's many impacts to fire and life safety due to construction and healthcare. And again, as we talked about, in healthcare, since patients may not be capable of self-rescue, these fire and life safety impacts are of critical importance. From a Joint Commission perspective, the fire and life safety impacts are one of the most important. Just a few weeks ago, I was involved in a Joint Commission survey, and the life safety surveyor had asked to see documentation of their interim life safety measures policy and what measures they put in place for different life safety risks. Some examples of life safety risks due to construction would be changes to the exit or egress features, any alterations or shutting down of the fire detection, alarm, or suppression systems, and then any major deficiencies in the life safety code. Other risks might include combustible loading, risks from hot work, which we've talked about a little bit already. Whenever there is a deficiency in the life safety code due to either construction or some other deficiency, Joint Commission requires that you have an interim life safety measures in place, and we'll talk about these interim life safety measures in the next couple of slides. This particular photograph here is of a smoke detector, and this was a deficiency we kept seeing at one particular hospital, time in and time out. They would bag these smoke detectors without doing a proper shutdown. They would use tape or bag them, and that resulted in a delay of the fire alarm system in case there was fire or smoke in the area. Some root causes of a deficiency like this really would be the ability to resolve deficiencies in a timely manner. We kept seeing this issue time and time again. And so we want to make sure that when you're seeing deficiencies out there in your construction areas, that you have processes in place to correct those deficiencies, retrain contractors and subcontractors, and really see your data trend so that you're seeing an improvement in safety performance and PICRA performance. Okay, so we talked about these interim life safety measures, and again, this is of critical importance to Joint Commission. As many of you probably do know, the interim life safety measures are required to be put in place whenever there are deficiencies in the life safety code. We mentioned they may be due to construction or other causes of deficiencies. There are really four major questions to ask yourself when considering whether or not you need to implement interim life safety measures. Does this project compromise the integrity of an exit? Does the project significantly compromise the building's defend-in-place compartmentation features? So does it impact the firewalls, the smoke barriers, the corridor walls? Does the project impair the building's code-required fire alarm, detection, or suppression systems? And does the project involve the presence of a large amount of combustible or debris? If it's a yes to any of those four questions, you want to have an interim life safety matrix to fill out and then implement the proper life safety measures, interim life safety measures, to mitigate those risks. Well, give an example of a life safety deficiency at a particular hospital. They were doing some hot work, so again, some welding type activities. And at this particular hospital, there was a sprinkler impairment due to this renovation project. And what happened next? There was a fire in this particular hospital. The fire was caused by the hot work, was the initial source of the fire. And there wasn't an impairment to the sprinkler system in this small area of the hospital. Due to this hot work, which resulted in a fire, there was an evacuation of an isolated area of this particular hospital. Really, this illustrates how important management and coordination is. Here's an example of how central coordination could have helped mitigate an event like this. At one hospital where EH&E has worked, we developed this planning tool. And what this planning tool really allows you to do is it allowed for the building engineers to assess how much impact is on that fire detection, alarm, and suppression system, and how much impact is too much. What's the risk of having that sprinkler impaired? This hospital uses this tool to manage staffing for engineering and maintenance, and also determine if hot work or other high-risk activities are acceptable under the building conditions, or potentially if project phasing is required. So what this management tool really allows you to do is look at what the real-time conditions are for this hospital building. The shutdown to the fire suppression system or fire detection systems occur at many hospitals on a routine basis. So it allows you to really do a risk assessment of what's the risk due to the sprinkler impairment and some other high-risk activities such as hot work. So that's a potential solution to resolve an issue like this. Okay, and so additional requirements from Joint Commission. Joint Commission requires that you assess and mitigate the impact on patient well-being from the effects of noise and vibrations, and also the impact on utilities and medical equipment. At one particular hospital where we worked, there was a renovation project that was scheduled directly next to a sleep study program. And so this sleep study program, they would take volunteer participants and they would have various sleep studies that might last 14 or 21 days. They would sleep at times during the day, they would sleep for long stretches of time and then give them a stimulus to wake them up under the sleep study. And so what they wanted to make sure was that they didn't wake up under uncontrolled conditions. In this particular renovation project, we had to really control the risk of noise and vibration. And some ways you can do that is sequencing of the project so that the noisy activities are mitigated as much as possible, but then conducted at the most convenient time. And again, here's another example where coordination is really critical. With utility and medical equipment, in one particular case, there was a new patient tower being conducted or being built next to the existing patient tower. And so the medical gases had to be tied in from this new patient tower into the existing patient tower. And again, another example where coordination, clear communication is critical. You have to let nursing staff know well in advance of any potential impairment. We had to make stipulations for the amount of compressed medical gases that would be available while this equipment was down. And so in both these cases, again, central coordination is key to program success. Okay. And then lastly, but certainly not least, Joint Commission requires that you assess and mitigate the impacts on infection control. As Kevin mentioned, this coming Thursday, we'll be having a second webinar on some practical information for the infection control risk assessment. Construction can really have a real impact on patient safety. We talked about the case of the hospital-acquired aspergillosis. The death rate for these hospital-acquired fungal infections in immune-compromised patients, such as bone marrow transplants, is very high. And so we'll talk more about this infection control risk assessment and its mitigation procedures in the next slide here. This infection control matrix is one that you may have seen at your hospital. Really, just to simplify this very briefly is, you know, construction potentially can equal dust. Dust can potentially equal mold. And mold plus that high-risk patient equals an elevated patient risk. And so, really, this infection control risk assessment, it focuses on the reduction of risk from infection. It's really for all your facility phases. It's for all phases of construction, from planning, design, construction, renovation, and maintenance. You want to ensure you're not forgetting your infection control risk assessment during renovation and maintenance procedures. These can have a real critical impact on patient safety as well. They have the ability to generate dust as well. Just as a very brief review, this infection control risk assessment, basically there's two steps here. First, you assign the patient risk group from low to high. High would be something like a bone marrow transplant, where the inherent susceptibility to infection is very high, the patients are immunocompromised. And then the construction type from A to D, and D would be some large-scale renovation or demolition work. You combine the patient risk group with the construction type, and that gives you your infection control risk class, and then the mitigation measures are in place that correspond to that infection control risk list class. And so that's some real basic information on the infection control risk assessment. I want to give you a case study of an infection control risk assessment issue or infection control issue. This particular example here, this is actually a bridge, and this bridge is connecting two nearby but different hospitals. And the bridge was being constructed to connect these two hospitals. The majority of the project was actually managed by Hospital A's construction or project management team. Now, Hospital A conducted an infection control risk assessment, while Hospital B, that adjacent hospital, did not conduct an infection control risk assessment because it was really actually managed by the other hospital, Hospital A's project management team. But both hospitals were aware of the project because it involved a breakthrough into their hospital areas. Now in Hospital B, there was some routine air sampling done in an adjacent area to that bridge, and we found very high dust levels. It turned out that bridge was positively pressurized from the bridge into Hospital B. So what that means is that air was blowing from the bridge into Hospital B. Now once Hospital A and Hospital B began to review the project, it was better managed, and there were no dust issues for either Hospital B or Hospital A. In this particular case, what happened was Hospital B did not conduct an infection control risk assessment because it wasn't on their project management minutes. And so they were sort of blindly following protocol, and what happened was there was a potential risk due to this pressurization issue from the bridge here. So some potential root causes of how something like this could happen. First of all, you have to have a consistent and effective review process. And so not just consistent, but I really want to emphasize the word effective. You have to assure that your systems take into account these risks. Otherwise, you can really miss some really obvious risks, even risks as obvious as a bridge being connected to your hospital. Great. And so as we talked about, one of the keys to infection control is site isolation. We'll be giving a lot more detail to infection control in our Thursday webinar. Part of site isolation is construction barriers, which many of you are familiar with, I'm sure, and also maintaining a negative pressure differential. There's just a few pictures here of some good containment practices and some bad containment practices. In the good practices, you'll notice this, in both cases now, this is a fire-retardant plastic or fire-retardant poly-containment, and so it's a temporary containment. Typically, you'll use this temporary containment for construction projects lasting 7 to 10 days, really no more than that. And so in this good example, you'll see that the temporary containment is at a negative pressure relative to the hospital area, It's taped at the floor, at the seams, and up by the ceiling. Now, in the example of the poor construction isolation or poor construction containment, this is the view from the construction side into the patient care area. And now you can see that this is positively pressurized, or the air is flowing from the construction site into the clinical or patient care environment. The way you can tell that is that plastic, that temporary plastic, is flowing out. So the flow of air is really flowing into the construction area. So that's just an example of some temporary construction containment materials. I do want you to note that in both cases, this is a fire retardant plastic. And we'll illustrate on the next slide what can happen when you don't have a fire retardant plastic. This is a fire that resulted. The fire actually resulted when they were doing some hot work again, so a familiar theme. They were doing hot work in a case where there was not a fire retardant plastic. And so specifically, an accident like this could have been prevented by using fire retardant plastic, but also by properly implementing a fire watch or an assessment of hot work areas. Oftentimes, it's recommended that you do monitoring for 30 minutes after the cessation of hot work. And so what you're doing there is you're looking for any smoke or fire after you stop doing hot work. This particular fire occurred at 9:15 in the morning, which is right in the middle of typical coffee breaks for many construction areas. And so, again, you want to make sure you're using fire retardant plastic and make sure you're doing your fire watch or assessment of hot work areas. And so some potential root causes for issues like this, competencies and skills. You want to make sure in-house or from the outside you have some skills or competencies to properly manage your hot work, ensure that the right materials are used, that fire retardant plastic. Make sure that hot work policy and procedure requires that you do a fire watch or an observation of the hot work area for a certain amount of time afterwards. Also contractor training and also enforcement. You want to train the contractors and enforce those requirements. Great, so that's an example of some life safety risks. Okay, so what can go wrong? Here are some examples of what can go wrong in hospitals. We've talked about these nosocomial hospital-acquired fungal infections, those aspergillosis. Staff injury and illness is of real concern. And we saw that with one of our case studies as well. Joint Commission accreditation. Joint Commission is very focused on this pre-construction risk assessment. Of critical importance are the life safety issues, interim life safety measures, and also the infection control risk assessment process. You can see liability and insurance premiums go up. Many hospitals are self-insured these days. And so by reducing your construction risk, you can really reduce construction costs. We've seen a lot of staff complaints and dissatisfaction from dust, odors, and noise. And these can really result in the construction stoppage that we talked about. So these are some examples of what can go wrong. Now the root causes. So we'll talk about these root causes here of what's the root cause of failure with the pre-construction risk assessment. The PCRA program, as we talked about, has interdepartmental responsibility, and so there's various subtasks that really go into this PCRA program. Unfortunately, though, these interdepartment responsibilities between facilities, infection control, engineering, environmental health and safety, they can sometimes result in ambiguity, a lack of ownership. Who's the process owner for your PCRA program? You have to define that early and often in your PCRA program for it to be successful. Also, as we talked about in one of the earlier slides, you know, construction contractors, they'll be one of the first to tell you they're focused on job completion and maintaining the schedule. And so you really need to clearly communicate to these contractors what the expectations are and train them in ways to mitigate these risks. Same with subcontractors. For many organizations, subcontractors are the largest risk. And so what we recommend is a contractor orientation to ensure that subcontractors and contractors and subcontractors are familiar with the risks in construction and it's very clearly defined what they have to do to work safely in hospitals. In many cases, they may be unfamiliar with the healthcare environment, so you have to assure that they understand those risks. Okay, so as we talked about, from a Joint Commission compliance accreditation perspective, we all know it's documentation, documentation, documentation. At EH&E, for several years now, we've been trying to think of simple ways to assure that multidisciplinary and interdepartmental programs with numerous responsibilities spread across your hospital has a central location for critical program information. Here's one particular solution we came up with. This is our automated pre-construction risk assessment assistant. And what this tool allowed us to do at a couple of hospitals is that it tracks important Joint Commission requirements. We can provide critical program metrics. Basically, what you do is you put in some basic information about that project, the project location, start and end dates, project managers, project numbers. Those are all assigned into the database. You go through a series of questions and ask a series of steps. And what this assistant will do, it'll automate the infection control risk assessment level. It can print off permits and assign the appropriate level of risk mitigation based on the inputs into the program. And also it can track inspection data, provide report cards of site compliance. Great. Now here's an example of the permitting process. And so one key to success that we found is clear communication with all the stakeholders is very important in hospitals. And so one way we've achieved this is actually posting permits on the entrance to all construction renovation areas at a couple of hospitals. These construction permits will clearly list out what the requirements are so that interested parties from the nursing staff, if they're concerned, they can look at the responsible actions. And also we will put contact information on there so if folks have complaints or concerns, they can contact a central person. Okay, what we've also done is, here's an example of our inspection forms. And so these inspection forms are customizable. It allows you to document all of your construction inspections. Based on these construction inspections, what we've been able to do is we actually generate these report cards. And what these report cards can do is that for a few hospitals, we've been able to track the PICRA program performance, so that safety performance for your construction project, by project manager, by contractor, and by subcontractor. And so we use that critical data both in training, in retraining of contractors and subcontractors, and also we use that data to help resolve common reoccurring deficiencies. At many hospitals where I've worked, we keep seeing the same issues time and time again, whether it be improperly isolated construction areas or housekeeping issues around there or serious fire and life safety issues. We kept seeing the same common deficiencies. In addition to that, we use report cards to help identify any problematic trends that might be tied to the performance of contractors, subcontractors, and project managers. So we've really used this report card to manage the program and manage the contractors and subcontractors. Okay. Some other issues to think about, to consider. Site inspections. Who's doing the site inspections? How is that data reported? As we've talked about throughout this presentation, we really want to make sure that our management structure is such that our performance of our program is as good as possible. And so we want to make sure that when we're identifying deficiencies, those deficiencies are resolved. You want to think about vetting and selecting contractors that have worked in healthcare, that understand the risks of working in healthcare, and also management of subcontractors. This is one of the greatest risks for many hospitals, and you really want to ensure that you manage these subcontractors as well. There are many OSHA compliance issues that can be part of this pre-construction risk assessment, from asbestos to lockout, tagout, and confined space. This program is really scalable. Once you set up the bones or skeleton to this program, you can add on various program components for asbestos, lockout, tagout, confined space. You can include the critical components of fire stopping and above-the-ceiling work permits once you set up the skeletons or bones to this program. So it really is a scalable program. Great. And so we want to come back and really talk about the proven success strategies of a PICRA program. Remember now, the fundamental goals of a PICRA management program are to protect the health and safety of the patients, staff, visitors, contractors, and vendors. We really want to minimize the disruption to the renovation activities and also maintain compliance with regulations. So to that end, in EH&E's experience, an effective management process for the pre-construction risk assessment is really required. And so the PICRA program management really must address some really critical elements. You have to have a PICRA management policy. There should be a central program coordinator or coordinators to coordinate the subtasks to the program. I really can't make this point enough, is you must really clearly define the roles and responsibilities of all these subtasks which feed into the umbrella program of the pre-construction risk assessment. You want to make sure there's no ambiguity in your program. Really clearly define those responsibilities. It has to be documentation and record-keeping requirements. There should be training for contractors, subcontractors, also hospital staff as well. The training should go beyond the contractors and subcontractors, cover your nursing and clinical staff as well. Okay, so EH&E has really found that clearly defining roles and responsibilities and also mechanisms to track and trend various program elements are critical to the success of the program, given the number of stakeholders and responsible parties, folks from facilities, infection control, construction, environmental health and safety. So you really want to very clearly define the roles of these folks. Okay, so some other proven success strategies that we found. Again, you want to take a look at which contractors and subcontractors are in your hospital. Train those contractors. It sounds basic, but you have to communicate to the contractors and subcontractors what the requirements are of working in your hospitals. Those requirements should be crystal clear. Finally, to reduce and mitigate risks, you must determine your hospital's vulnerabilities. Whether those vulnerabilities be imperfect management processes, lack of training or accountabilities for your contractors or subcontractors, whether that be improper resources dedicated to your PICRA program or program coordination, or whether it be insufficient processes to ensure inspection findings and program deficiencies are resolved. Once you've determined your hospital's vulnerabilities, you want to act to address those vulnerabilities. You want to continually improve your hospital's performance in the pre-construction risk assessment process. And I want to thank you for your time today, and I'll hand it back over to Kevin.
Great. Thanks so much, Brian. That was, a very informative and certainly very comprehensive presentation. This concludes the presentation portion of today's webinar, and we're now going to go directly to the question and answer period. And we will be ending this webinar promptly at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time in respect of everyone's time. And just to let you know, if we do not get to your question, this is being recorded, and we will also respond to everybody through email if there are questions that have not been answered, and we will send that out to all the attendees so everyone has an opportunity to see the answer to those questions that did not get answered. Again, if you need to submit a question, and we welcome any and all questions, just please submit them by entering your question into the chat box located at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. And so at this point, I'm going to go, and we do have a number of questions here already lined up, and we're going to go ahead and get right to the questions. The first question is, if I have a ceiling that is out of an area like medical records due to a sprinkler maintenance, how should that area be handled? We cannot move all the files, and we cannot close off that area.
Okay, great. And so this seems to be getting at a couple of issues here. One is you do want to conduct infection control risk assessment for an issue like this. And so what that infection control risk assessment will take into account is whether or not patients are nearby. Now, medical records, it's mostly administrative staff who are nearby. And then you'll want to figure out how much dust could be generated from an issue like this. Now, I noticed there was a leak in this particular issue. So remember, whenever we have a moisture source with a porous material, there's that potential for mold being in the area. And so you will want to look at the infection control risk assessment and really put in place some mitigation procedures to ensure you properly contain any risk to dust being disturbed. And also, in this particular issue, I would have an industrial hygienist or an infection control practitioner do an inspection of the area, look for any sources of mold or moisture. Now, these medical records can be very critical to hospitals as well. So from insurance and liability perspective, you want to make sure that you attend to this issue as soon as possible so you don't have any loss to medical records.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Another question we have, I think, relates back to the infection control risk assessment or the matrix in particular. And the question is, what do the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 mean?
Sure. So that is the infection control risk assessment risk class. And so for each corresponding risk class, there's a set of mitigation procedures in place. And so the higher the risk class, the higher the control procedures you'll put in place. And so really what you're doing there is you're setting up the mitigation procedures to correspond to how sensitive those patients are and how much that construction might generate dust or disturb or create infection control risk. I do want to note, too, that we'll be going in much more detail with the infection control risk assessment in Thursday's webinar as well.
Great. Thanks, Brian. On a related question, this next question says, at what level of maintenance or type of maintenance activity do you I'm sorry, I just lost the question there. At what level of maintenance or maintenance activity do you initiate the ICRA process?
So really, it's for every level here. Whenever you're doing work that could create dust, you want to work with an infection control risk assessment. Now, there may be routine procedures that you can have preset ICRAs for, and that's something we recommend in many places. And so what that means is maybe there's a particular task, like removal of one ceiling tile or inspection of a patient care area. And so for these procedures that won't generate a whole lot of dust, you still want to do the infection control risk assessment, but what you can do is you can preset sort of the mitigation procedures in advance of those activities. But remember, it's not just the activity. It's the patient risk group. And so the mitigation procedures for a medical records area is going to be much different than from a bone marrow transplant procedure. And so to answer the question, it's really for every level of maintenance, but you can preset or predefine what those mitigation measures will be for the common maintenance activities.
That's a good point. So you can actually have sort of a standard protocol for certain routine activities that happen over and over again, so you don't necessarily have to get bogged down in an ICRA review process every single time you're doing a maintenance activity.
Exactly, yep, absolutely. And we've done that for many hospitals where we've helped define their routine activities done in maintenance and engineering. As many of you know who work from the engineering or facility side of things, you know, you can't be doing paperwork every single day. So what we'll do for these folks is we'll predefine that risk level across a wide spectrum.
Great, thanks. Moving on, Brian, to the hot work issue that you brought up. You had a couple of interesting slides there. If hot permits are being used in our hospital, do we need to do fire watches? And if so, how often?
Okay. And so there's a couple of things to think about with hot work permits. You need to talk to your authority having jurisdiction, which will typically be your local fire department. Many authorities having jurisdictions have specific requirements for hot work permits. You also need to speak with your insurance carriers. Many insurance carriers may require a hot work permitting process. And so really it's the mitigation procedures are defined by the local authority having jurisdiction and by your insurance from your insurance carrier. But as a best practice, after you cease doing hot work, so after that hot work activity has ended, you want to have a process by which somebody for a certain amount of time, typically about 30 minutes, is looking around for any smoke or sparks due to that hot work. So go ahead and speak with your authority having jurisdiction and your insurance carrier for the exact requirements for your hospital. But as a best practice, you do want to have an observation of that area for an amount of time after the hot work. And at least two of our case studies really demonstrated how real the risks are with hot work.
Great. And a follow-up on that, Brian, I know there was a case where, sometimes insurance companies have to be notified of various impairments of smoke detection or certainly suppression systems,
exactly.
And that can change by carrier a little bit. And it doesn't always, the facilities manager may not always be knowledgeable of the requirements. It may be sort of in an insurance or risk management area of the hospital. So, again, coordination among the various departments and levels of responsibility are important to make sure that everything's being addressed properly.
Absolutely. I agree.
Now, Brian, this next question relates to the PIC growth process and the software that you actually mentioned in your presentation. And the question is the PIC growth process software available online, or can it be purchased?
Yes, the PICRA software can be purchased. It's customizable. We can give us a call. We can talk to you about sort of the details associated with that program.
Terrific. And here's another question, again relates to the work permits and the paperwork. And it says, how long or how many years do we keep the PICRA form or work permit, et cetera?
I would recommend you keep these PICRA forms and work permits for one joint commission cycle. I've been involved in several joint commission audits recently, and in several of them, they've asked us to go back and look at the interim life safety measures matrix and which measures we put in place. Now, sometimes they'll just ask you to get your last one or for the last year or so, but I'd really recommend keeping all these documentations for PICRA for one full joint commission cycle. At least.
Okay. Great. And there's another question here that relates to the notes from this lecture. Can we get a copy of these notes? And this, for everybody that's on this call is being recorded, and it will be available for download. And we can certainly make a PDF of the slides available to those who are interested. Simply just contact us through our website at ehinc.com. Okay. And let's move on. There's some other questions here, Brian, that seem to relate again to infection control or air quality. And there's a question that says, is there a time requirement that contractors need to change filters to the air handling units if projects go on for several months inside the hospital?
Okay. So there's, a couple of ways to think about this particular question here. One would be if it was a freestanding hospital that's sort of connected to your existing hospital. This looks like it's talking about inside the hospital here, so a construction area. Now, you want to protect your existing air handling unit, so there's some ways you can do that. You should protect the return air diffusers with filtration. You want to ensure that you're isolating that construction area so you're not impacting your existing air handling units. As for the exact requirement, it's going to depend on what the activity is and the type of air handling equipment that you have at your hospital.
So I think if this question relates to the actual air handler serving the hospital, obviously you'd hope that your filter change regime doesn't really change very much because you
right.
don't want that dust
exactly.
or debris getting into those filters,
yep.
right? And so that would be the point there is to do a good job controlling the dust.
Exactly.
Another question here, Brian, that relates to the actual designation of the work area. And the question is, if the work area is in an area considered to be a business occupancy or business area, do you still need to do or follow the PICRA process?
Well, if there's any risk to a patient care area, Joint Commission would require that you do a pre-construction risk assessment. If you're just in a business occupancy, strictly from a Joint Commission perspective, you would not be required to do interim life safety measures because that really relates to the healthcare occupancy. As I mentioned, this program is very scalable, so you could use this process to manage construction risk in a business area. But if it's interim life safety measures, Joint Commission would not require that you do an interim life safety measure assessment. What you need to do, though, is if that business area has any potential impacts on a patient area, you need to look at those risks in that same management process.
Yeah, I could see if you had a standalone unit, Brian, a standalone clinic, let's say, that's classified as business occupancy because the type of care that's being provided, that's one thing. But I find, at least, and I don't know if this reflects your experience, in a hospital setting where you have a business occupancy, it's typically located adjacent to a patient care area, and it's really, you know, fire and air quality and noise and vibration can travel throughout a facility. And so even though the source of the hazard might be in a business occupancy, the impacts can be felt in a patient care area.
Absolutely.
Great. This next question, Brian, relates back to that flammable gas issue that you showed the slide of the exploding job box there. And the question reads, what do you recommend for flammable gas storage during renovation or construction? Stored in a properly fire-rated storage area at end of use or outside of building?
And so, yeah, in this particular example, we sort of gave a case study of what can go wrong here. And we really want to make sure that these flammable gases are accounted for. We want to make sure no issues such as the leaking one into the job box can occur. And so what NFPA requires that is you store this in a properly ventilated area. So you should designate that area in your hospital. Oftentimes it will be outside the building. We've seen some very successful strategies for outside the building. If you keep it inside the building, it should typically be away from the construction or renovation area, but in a well-ventilated designated area. And then those tanks should be moved. They should be stored in that location. They shouldn't be stored in the construction or renovation area. They need to be stored in the storage area and then just used in the construction or renovation area. We've even gone as far to do sign-out procedures for these tanks in some hospitals.
Great. Thanks, Brian. I think there was a clarification on the question we answered earlier regarding the air filtration devices the air handlers and the filters. And it appears that the question was related to these portable air handling units that are run inside a construction zone to perhaps depressurize them. And the question, again, related to filter change-out frequencies for those particular units in a construction zone that's operating perhaps for months.
Sure. And that's a great question. I was wondering about that when I read it the first time. And so what we're talking about are those negative pressure or negative air machines with HEPA filtrations. Each of those filters should be certified in the contractor. This recommendations for the type of filter based on the manufacturer of that negative air machine. And so we should look back at the contractor requirements for a filter changeout. But the important point is to change out those filters. Not only to change them out, but believe it or not, we've seen many negative air machines that don't have HEPA filters in them at all. So it'll be machines running without filtration units. So you want to make sure, first of all, that there's filtration within the negative air machine, that it's working properly. These negative air machines can get jarred around and damaged pretty easily. Once the filters get damaged, they can really result in failure. And so you want to make sure it's in place, working properly, and then change per the manufacturer's recommendations.
And just to follow up on that, Brian, from my experience, you know, sometimes you'll have these contractors come in from, say, an asbestos abatement project or a lead abatement project, and they're wheeling in these units and they're not properly cleaned, and if they don't have the proper filtration in them, there's a chance you could actually contaminate another portion of the hospital you're not careful. So I know one of the things that I've seen spec'd out in these PICRA programs is that they're not allowed to bring air filtration devices that have been used in other hazardous abatement environments. They can only use either brand new or cleaned and certified units that have not been used in those hazardous environments. And also to answer this question as well, I know that there's the typical pressure drop across these HEPA filters is about an inch of water, and there's typically gauges on the side of these units. And as that pressure drop increases, then that can be used as an indicator to when the filter needs to be changed. And I think the manufacturers of those devices also have some guidance as to at what pressure drop do you need to actually change out the filters.
Great point, Kevin.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our scheduled time, and in order to respect the time of all attendees, we are going to conclude the webinar. There are a number of unanswered questions, and as I indicated earlier, we will be answering these questions and sending them out by email to all the attendees and participants today, so we'll be looking for those. There's also a number of questions that related to the PICRA process tool, the management tool that Brian spoke about today and showed some examples of in some of the screenshots. And to get some more information on that, we would like to invite everybody to log on to our website at eheinc.com. And under our healthcare area, you can access information on this PICRA tool. And you can also contact us directly at Environmental Health and Engineering at 1-800-825-5343. And that's simply 1-800-TALK-EHE. And you can ask for either Brian Connors or myself, Kevin Coggan, and we'll be happy to talk to you in more detail about how this tool might be helpful for your facility. If you do log on to our website, we have a number of free healthcare resources that you might find useful. We have white papers, archived presentations. We also have EHE Connect, which is an environment of care client online forum to post questions to your peers regarding questions concerning the environment of care. And we've also just initiated EC Bits, which is our latest resource for our healthcare clients on the go. They're small 8 to 10 minute MP3 files of different pointers on the various aspects of the environment of care, including a recent one that was posted regarding the PICRA process, and that's all available at eheinc.com. Thank you all for joining us and attending us today, and we hope you certainly will join us in the future. This concludes today's webinar.